Please note that the information and advice provided via the Things I Forgot Were Good For Me podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed or substituted for professional medical advice, counselling, or any other type of therapy or professional advice. I do not provide specific medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. And if you have any concerns about a medical condition, please consult with your GP or other qualified healthcare provider. Please do not disregard professional medical advice or delay seeking it because of something you've heard whilst listening to this podcast. Hi everyone, I'm Rada.
And I'm Giles.
And we're your trusted guides for the Things I Forgot Were Good For Me podcast. The podcast that helps you remember, relearn, rediscover and be inspired by others about what might help you feel good on this journey that we call life.
And we're starting right now on our journey to discover those things you forgot were good for you and inspire you to remember them. So without further ado, let's talk about this week's theme. This week, we talked to Sarah Stein-Lubrano, content lead at the School of Life. She chats to us about their book, On Failure, How to Succeed at Defeat. Sarah holds a bachelor's degree from Harvard College and an MPhil in political thought and intellectual history from Cambridge University. She's currently reading for a DPhil in political theory at Oxford University. We chat about why we as a society are afraid of failure, how to deal with mistakes, how to deal with others' opinions when we fail, and how to find perspective, and why it is helpful for us to expect and get used to failing. Rada and I were talking about it before we started recording, and always saying that how much the negative connotations around failure there are. And having a conversation with my son this week, we were going through some homework and he was getting bits wrong, and he sort of turned over and was like, "Oh, I'm a failure." And I said to him, but so, and I was trying to explain to him that, you know, that obviously he, at that moment, he feels that failure is a bad thing. But I was sort of saying that actually, this is an opportunity to have another go at it. What first led you to sort of being inquisitive and wondering about failure as a concept?
Well, I mean, the main thing is, you know, this is a collective book that we wrote all together at the School of Life. And the main reason that we write about failure is because it's the main thing that we all do, right? And I think even prior to, you know, we have these societal narratives that failure is good because it teaches you things, or you'll like learn key skills and then in the future you'll succeed even harder. But we actually have a thought on all of that that's prior to that point. Maybe sometimes it will teach you something and that's great. But also it's just the main activity in at least many categories of life. Like most of the things you try, you will fail at a lot of the time. Most businesses fail in their first year. Most companies fail in the long run. Most jobs we apply to, we won't get. You know, Google accepts 3% of applications for employees there. Almost nobody ever is a self-made person. It's just a fact. Most of the things that we idealize as success in our current society are nearly impossible in some ways. And we think that in order to live a good life, which is the main thing that we talk about constantly at the School of Life, a meaningful life, a fulfilling life, we have to be really open with ourselves about this. The failure is just something that happens. Prior to any possible benefit to us in the long run, we just need to see it as part of what it means to be alive. And if we don't, we're living under a sort of problematic ideology, essentially, which has many different roots, because not every culture has the same relationship to failure that our own modern westernized capitalist ideology has.
And I think you're so right. It's interesting what you said, Giles, about your son, because I wonder, you know, what age sort of children or we all start to sort of hear that word failure, and we start to become used to the word of that concept of failing at something. Because, you know, when we're very little, you know, we go about our business, we do things. Children are very good at doing something, and then if something goes wrong, in inverted commas, they tend to forget about it quite quickly and move on. They don't necessarily have this long lasting psychological label that we have as adults of, oh, I've failed at that, and that means that I can't do anything, unless obviously it's reinforced by an adult who is around them, or perhaps they're getting some feedback on that. So it's interesting, I think, what kind of age we actually hear the word failure and fail, because I think it's very much related to exams, which obviously are, yeah, you know, academic exams, which obviously we're kind of being exposed to at a very young age. That was the first time I was ever kind of aware of the concept of having to reach a certain expectation or a certain level or a certain grade in order to be good, and then if you didn't get that, you'd failed. And right, that word was really scary to me at school, because I was youngest of four and my brothers and sisters all passed things quite well, they all got good marks, and so for me the idea of failing an exam was like the worst thing ever. So I think it's an interesting idea, when do we actually start to become aware of the concept of failure and what that means, because it's not really an innate concept, I don't think.
Yeah, not at all. I think you're absolutely right. It's in school, usually for most people. And actually what we style ourselves as a school, we have classes for adults. But what we do in our class on failure, and we are gently reworking our curriculum, so there'll be a new one soon. But for now, what we do in our class on failure is we show them, at the very beginning of the class, we just show them some pots. And first we show everyone these beautiful, elaborate French vases that have these little drawings of shepherds on them, and they are worth some millions and millions of pounds, and they're perfect, you know, they're perfectly symmetrical, the shepherds look very charming, nothing is scratched about them,
and they've all been to a spa, they've had their, yeah, hair done.
This is a Western ideal of beauty, right? This was like the best vase that you could get in the 1700s, and then we show them some vases from Japan, and in particular we show them what are called kintsugi pottery, which is when something has been purposefully broken. It's already, by the way, not perfectly symmetrical or anything like that. It's meant to look made by humans and therefore imperfect, which is a very important connection to make, that anything by humans is imperfect. And then it's been, after it's shattered, it's been carefully pieced back together with gold glue so that you can see very clearly all the faults and the human failure and the breaking and the putting back together. And we say, this is a completely equally legitimate idea about what beauty is. But we don't have it as strongly in our own culture. And that's actually a great disservice to us. And I think what I try to do when I think about failure is to remind myself that the whole concept of failure is because we have these weird little shepherd vases, right? Except in every category of life. We have it for what it means to be a professional. We have it for what it means to be a parent. We have it for what it means to be a lover, you know, friend, etc. And you have to kind of go looking for that other vase.
That's a lot of shepherds, isn't it? A lot of shepherds around.
Yeah, I think school is the first place where we sort of really divide these things up into either like perfect or bad. And in particular, we suggest that it's very unusual to have done badly, but it's very usual to have done badly. It's the most normal thing there is. And I think schools have a lot to answer for there. There's a big ongoing debate about the role of testing and assessment in schools, but increasingly people are beginning to feel that, especially the way we do it, and maybe to some degree the fact that we have grades at all, is very harmful to children in a lot of cases.
Because I think Giles and I were talking before about how, you know, failure is only really viewed as failure, or in our own minds, or we decide we failed at something if we've had expectations of it being different to how it's turned out. And so failure, I think, is very much related to expectation, and it's very much related to perfection, which is, again, just an illusion. And those kind of two concepts get kind of muddled up. And I think your idea and why that book is so great is that it's all about normalizing failure. And not making it something out of the ordinary, but actually just saying, yeah, this is totally normal and it's going to happen more times to you than not. So let's get used to it and get comfortable with it, because otherwise you're going to find life quite challenging.
yeah, absolutely. And I think we have to really see the artificialness of it in all of its forms. For example, the fact that our reputations are so permanent and forever etched on the internet. We have quite a bit in our book about this. And I think the reason that that's important is that we have to remember that, you know, like the internet is also an artificial thing that will probably melt very soon And, you know, aliens, when they come down to look at our civilization, will mainly see sort of scattered remains of skyscrapers or whatever. No one will know that we once did something very embarrassing and the Daily Mail reported on it or whatever. the more we can sort of denaturalize everything that reeks of failure and just see it as like humans wander around making fun of each other or whatever, the better. Because otherwise, it's a sad story for everyone. We're all there.
Yeah. It was interesting. You said about different cultures have a different way of dealing with failure. And I was interested to know what you kind of meant by that and how in a capitalist Western mm-hmm. world, how we've got this construct of failure. Is there
yeah, a difference? Absolutely. I mean, I don't want to pretend to be, you know, like an expert on all other cultures or anything like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think a good way of thinking about this is towards the end of the same class. I just love this class. I also love the book. They're very closely related, of course. I will often suggest to people, you know, what if you were mediocre for the rest of your life? And people are horrified. They're horrified by this. Many people are horrified by this suggestion. What do you mean mediocre? But then I point out to them that mediocre just means in the middle of the pack, right? If you've got a little bell curve, most people are mediocre. That's what they are. And what kind of society have we created if being mediocre is terrible news? And we really encourage people to think, you know, what would be nice about being mediocre? I'm mediocre at many things. Maybe that's fine. I'm sort of mediocre at going on runs and mediocre at knitting and mediocre at Excel spreadsheets and mediocre. It's fine. But this is a really hard adjustment. And we try to show them that that's, you know, historically contingent. So not only do societies that, for example, have an intense practice of Buddhism tend to view failure and brokenness as an innate part of the human condition, Zen Buddhism is part of the tradition that made that pot I described earlier, but also many religious traditions are very alive to this idea that human beings are innately a failure in some ways. And obviously this is complicated, partially, you know, I'm not endorsing any particular religion. I'm a very secular person myself, but there is something useful about those traditions anyway, because they point out that the starting point is failure in a way, right? The humans come into the world and that's what they're destined for. They're destined to screw up a lot, to harm each other quite a bit, to get things wrong. They're not omniscient, to put it mildly. And I think one of the things about our current world, for all kinds of reasons, but indeed in large part because of the competitiveness of capitalism and also the amazingness of our technology, is that we've forgotten that a little bit. We think, okay, but the iPhone is improved every 2 years, so why can't I become perfectible also? But we're not iPhones, right? And the iPhones are also sometimes screwed up, but we're not iPhones. And I think it's a very fine line to discern that difference, but that difference is an enormous important fact in our lives, that we're not like the technologies that we have, and we're not like the ideals that we're pushed to towards because of the economic structures that we have. We're our own weird little screwed up species.
That's really interesting, because what you said there, and I think this is so true, is that our society tends to give us this message that we should always be productive.
Yep.
That our value and our self-worth is all about productivity, and productivity ultimately is related to machines, isn't it? So when you look at machines and technology, mm-hmm. you know, they're designed to work, they're designed to produce, they're designed to, you know, if we press a button on our washing machine, it should work. But we're not, we're human.
And better yet every year.
Yes, you know, better every year.
It's not just enough to wash the clothes. They've got to next time have less something or other and more.
Absolutely. Yeah. More spin. Yeah, absolutely. And so I think we've almost, because of the way society kind of gives us this message of you need to be productive, you need to be achieving, you need to be keeping on improving and constantly, we've almost kind of become, we believe we are machines, and machines are not supposed to fail, therefore we shouldn't either. We've forgotten maybe the humanness and our ability or our need for space and downtime and rest mm-hmm. and all of those other things. And that I think also ties into what you're saying about failure, is that, you know, we are allowed to not achieve things, and we're allowed to be mediocre, and we're allowed not to update our software every 2 years as human beings, because we're not machines.
And these machines exist the way they do for a reason as well, right? I mean, even that can be denaturalized. That's a bad phrase, but it can be made less obvious and natural. The reason we like our extremely efficient machines is that they allow us to get that tiny little sliver of profit at the top of whatever we're doing. And that's very nice for this or that entrepreneur, and people in the Bank of England are very pleased whenever there's a profit in a British company, and, you know, whatever, okay, it has its benefits here and there maybe, but It has nothing to do with the way humans are set up to function, really, right? It's an artificial thing that we really value profits, and we're constantly looking for efficiency to get those little profits. And there are all these competing firms, which is why so many of them have to go out of business. I mean, regardless of your political position, I would say if you look at that objectively, it has a lot to do with a particular system of accounting, but it doesn't have very much to do with how human beings are per se. And it's really important that we can separate ourselves from that psychologically. Otherwise, we've mistaken the kind of creatures that we are.
Mm. Do you think that there's a difference between mistakes and failure? Because I sort of think of a mistake as a one-off event or a one-off action.
We think so generally.
On the path to failure. And failure, so to me, kind of... there might be kind of like a parallel with sort of guilt and shame, where guilt is very much related to a discrete event or something that you've done, perhaps you're not, it's something you're not proud of for doing, but shame is actually an internal thing you actually put on your whole being. And it strikes me that maybe a mistake is a similar thing, that it's a discrete kind of action, but failure is more of a kind of an overall judgment on who you are as a person.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I do. And I also think, look, there are different things to talk about here. So there's one which is sort of, a lot of people see even being not mediocre as a failure, and there's something important to say about there, which we've already kind of touched on. But the other thing that we talk about in this book, and we really frame this book as a solve for, is that there are also big failures that happen in life that are not fixable. And I think this is very difficult for us to understand in our modern age of technology and medicine, because we think, but so many things are fixable. You know, I crash my car and someone fixes it. Whatever, I spend a bit too much money and I earn it back the next month. But then there are also these big catastrophic human failures, right? We become addicted to drugs for 10 years and it ruins our life. Our children don't want to speak to us anymore. We realize we've harmed our best friend and it's irreparable. And we also wrote this book for people that are going through that. And pretty much everyone is going to go through something like that in the course of their life, especially now that we're going through a period of immense economic and political turmoil as well, that has caused a lot of these sort of larger scale failures. So I would actually say that, you know, if I failed to show up for this podcast interview, that would be a mistake. But if I ruin irreparably a relationship with somebody I love, that's more like a failure in the big sense. We actually talk about this in terms of the fallibility of humans generally, but in particular, something the ancient Greeks talked about called hamartia, which is our sort of tragic flaw. And what's beautiful about Greek tragedies is that they show us people who have massively screwed up their lives, massively. They've killed their father and slept with their mother. They've done something that's ruined maybe the whole country even. And incidentally, we see lots of that in the real world today, don't we? But anyway, but the point they show us is, okay, some of these people are maybe bad or evil, like in a fairy tale, but most of these people are, it's more that they've just got a fundamental issue in some way that is intractable for them. They're just too curious. They can't let something go. They're too lustful. They're too arrogant. It's a huge one, of course. And their tragic flaw can take down a whole society with them. And so we wrote this book partially to sort of normalize mediocrity, yes, of course, but also to normalize like these big, big failures. It doesn't mean that they're good, but it does mean that even those enormous catastrophic years in our lives where we're going through something like that, we're still human and we're still more or less lovable people and we're still, you know, worthy of support. And I would say that's sort of part of the distinction between mistakes and big capital F failure.
I was going to ask, are there like practical things that people can do if they're going through a period of time where they feel like they're a failure? Is there a process that people can take on?
Yeah, of course, lots of things. I mean, we're not just a, you know, poetic philosophical organization. We also have all kinds of things that we help people with. We have therapy, which we think is extremely important, especially in a world that wants us to think less, maybe a clickbait world. It's very important to sit for an hour with your own thoughts. Even if you aren't particularly diagnosed with this or that mental illness, we think therapy is good for everyone. We provide therapy. We have classes. We also provide tools. One of the most popular is our philosophical meditation tool, which you can find online for free. But I think in terms of failure in particular, one of the things that we ask people to think about is the double-sidedness of any form of success that we want, right? We point out that, you know, if you're going to be extremely good at being a parent, you might actually necessarily need to be less good at your job and vice versa. And that's not something that we can get out of by updating our internal software. That's just what it is to be a person. And so one of the exercises that we suggest people undertake is to think very clearly about what forms of success are the most important, and then more or less factor in, account as an accountant, into our lives a certain number of failures in other directions, because these are real trade-offs, essentially. I think there's also something about we talk a lot about transcendence in this book that's come out, and I really love that. The idea that many of the things that we are extremely upset about, that someone said something nasty about us on Twitter, you know, that we're not getting promoted to the exact salary band that we wanted, whatever it is, even really big things like losing a spouse or, you know, having our reputation ruined because we did a truly awful thing or whatever it is, those things look very silly from the perspective of the brief existence of all of humanity on planet Earth, or the inevitable collapse of the solar system, or even just, you know, the view from the International Space Station. And one of the beautiful, difficult things about experiencing a lot of loss or failure in your life is that you can begin to try to adopt this position, which is outside of yourself, which is in fact basically a spiritual achievement, right? Many religious practices think this is incredibly important, that we are able to essentially get outside of ourselves and say, okay, this individual person I happen to inhabit has failed, but the universe as a whole is still vast and beautiful, and what's meaningful in it is much larger than anything in my own individual life. So anyway, I've just suggested a few things, but I do think it's not just that when we fail, we maybe figure out that we should have actually gone left instead of right, and we strengthen our skills as a result. It's also that it points us to another source of meaning in life outside of individual achievement or even success.
And do you think it's also something that can help us have more empathy for each other as well? Because yeah. I think, because like you said, we're all going to fail. No one is not going to fail on this planet. It's just impossible. And so actually, you know, if we kind of get a bit more comfortable with our own failures, and we also understand that failure is part of life, then actually if someone else in our lives who perhaps, you know, we're disappointed in, or we feel has let us down, or whatever that might be related to our expectations of them and nothing to do with them per se, but it perhaps can allow us to have more empathy for other people, and perhaps to have better relationships, because actually we have that give and take attitude and understanding of when things perhaps go wrong for someone else, or when, you know, things are difficult, and that means that we can have relationships which are a bit more meaningful, rather than the kind of relationships which you often read about in magazines, you know, in the hairdresser, which basically say to you, if someone makes a mistake in your life, then you just get rid of them and you move on. So maybe our ability to be with failure actually can help us have that kind of empathy and those kind of relationships for other people.
Yeah, I think it's much more meaningful it's sort of really, actually, if you've ever been to a party, you've met someone who's really successful, and that's mainly what they talk about, you know that it's unbearable.
and probably also untrue as well.
and very plausibly untrue, but even if it's true, it's unbearable. So, you know, there's something about sort of like, we only are really connected to people once we're sharing vulnerability, and most of our vulnerability is things we've failed at, either because we've been mediocre or because we've been truly off the rails, ruined our lives in some way. I think that's a much more interesting way of understanding other humans. And that's really what most friendships are based on in the long run, or at minimum on this sort of love that has nothing to do with whether the other person is successful. And I really think about this a lot when, you know, many people want success. And if you ask them why, oh, I want money. And why do you want money? I want money because I guess, well, then I could do this and that. But if you really boil down to why they want to be successful in a particular area, what they want, and it's rather heartbreaking, is to be liked, to be admired, and at some deep level, to be loved. And then, of course, one has to sort of gently pull back from that and say, well, maybe we should just cut to the thing we really want, which is to have relationships where other people admire us and respect us and love us and care about us, which might have nothing to do with the university degree, the car, the house, the job, the promotion, or how we seemed in that meeting. In a way, we're all kind of looking for friendship and love, and those are things we can cultivate outside of conventional paradigms of success. And so, yeah, I think absolutely, of course, failure makes us more empathic. We are able to finally imagine what other people are going through in some way, at least, although, of course, these are very imperfect models of other people's lives, and it's good to know that. But I also think it's one of the only things that really allows us to have connections at all. And oddly, it reminds us that what we really wanted in the first place was the connection, maybe more than the success.
So cut out all that time and energy wasted on the middle phase, and just cut to the chase, yeah. Go straight to it.
Yeah. It would be an immense achievement if you made one or two really good friends in your entire life. That's that's kind of what we're on planet Earth for, as far as we can tell at the School of Life, really. So
absolutely.
Yeah, it's funny when you just sort of break these things down, it often comes down to human connection for most things in life. I think it's interesting. I heard someone speaking recently about how our brains are very primitive still compared to, you know, we still have kind of Neanderthal brains to a certain extent, and we, you know, we react to things in a similar way. And I guess failure can be put under that as well. That kind of the fight or flight kind of things we see around negativity. And you sort of alluded to the fact that particularly with social media, we things like failure have been exacerbated somewhat. Would that be fair to say?
Well, I think, look, I also study psychology. I'm doing a PhD at Oxford in psychology and politics. And that means I have to get into this nitty gritty literature about psychology. And one of the main things you immediately run into is that we have a negativity bias, which means that we perceive negative information very quickly compared to sort of mediocre or positive information, even in many cases. And so that's good if you're, you know, trying to immediately avoid the tiger or the poisonous mushroom or the person that's about to stab you with a spear. But it's kind of unhelpful when it means that every single time our email alert comes up, we are immediately soaked in anxiety, right? So there's this kind of problem. But I also think you're pointing to something about sort of the socialness of it, right? It's social media. And what it does is it subjects our brains to our anxieties about the judgments of others, but at a scale that isn't really manageable. Because there are just truly billions of people on Twitter now, and the ability for us to somehow successfully navigate all of their opinions is zero. We can't do that. Mm-hmm. So all of the useful things, our emotions and our anxieties were doing for us when it was four or five people sitting around the fire, are no longer very helpful when we're working at a certain modern scale. And this is why some of the questions of failure are modern questions, right? Because the things we're failing at are impossible, complicated standards set up by our current system rather than some sort of abstract objective thing. So I think a lot of that's like a social media problem, so to speak. I'm not sure I quite answered your question there, but.
Yeah, no, I think you did, because it's the same with the news headlines, isn't it? We, you know, back in the day when we didn't have 24-hour news, we would perhaps just know about what was going on in our local village or town. Now we know what's happening all day, every day, all over the world. And that's, our brains can only take so much of that, and our systems can only take so much of that, because like you say, we don't have that. We've got the information, but we don't have the locus of control necessarily over that. And it's the same, I think, with social media. Like you said, it's not just, you're not just dealing with four or five of your friends. You're kind of trying to socialize with billions of people who you've never even met before. And like you say, there are lots of kind of pitfalls with that as well. In terms of failure, I mean, I think there have been examples through history of people coming up with the most incredible inventions because something failed. So I know, obviously, at the beginning we were talking about how there's a very typical attitude to failure. You know, we translate that into growth mindset of like, well, if we fail, it's good because then we learn, then we get better. And I know you're obviously saying that that's not necessarily the kind of angle or the kind of direction that you look at failure in. And I wonder if thinking about examples of where, you know, things have gone wrong, you know, with inventions, or people have been sitting there trying to work out a problem and something's gone wrong or something hasn't quite gone right, and then actually the perfect solution has come from that. I mean, do you think there are opportunities to come from failure? Do you agree with the whole sort of growth mindset conversation about actually failure can be good because we can learn from that, and as long as we're not making it about us being perfect, it still actually is a really good process to learn from and see as an opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, we use the growth mindset at the School of Life. We both talk about it internally with each other, and also we write about it, especially in our curriculum that's for organizations. So it's a very helpful idea. But I think it's worth saying that I often see it applied in a way I find slightly problematic, right? So this is for all the listeners that aren't immediately immersed in self-help psychology, this is a term from the psychologist Carol Dweck, and she started with children, and she noticed that children who are able to essentially see things that go wrong in their learning process specifically, as just, oh, okay, I'll try it another way, or that didn't go well, let me just, I'm going to keep growing, I'm capable of acquiring this skill, those children tend to do better in various ways. So, you know, the child who says, oh, I didn't solve the math problem correctly, but I can in the future, I'm capable of it, etc. That child does much better at math in the long run than the one who says, oh no, I got the wrong answer, I'm a huge failure, right? And she argues that one of the things you need to teach children in particular is this ability to say, I'm not there yet, right? But I can learn it. That's what a growth mindset is in the original literature. One of the things I just think is worth underscoring about that is that what's nice about the growth mindset is that it removes the specificity of individuality from the process. And I think that's actually weirdly the little inverted bit of what you're suggesting about failure. Like if we're trying to figure out how a light bulb works for the first time, if we're trying to invent the light bulb and we get it wrong, it's very unhelpful to think that we've gotten it wrong because we are stupid individually. And it's much more helpful to think that we just have got to try to make a light bulb 1,000 ways, right, before one of them works. And similarly, that, you know, abilities are things that we take time to acquire. So at the beginning, we're always going to be bad at something. The first draft of something is always terrible and so on. That there's a sort of baked in element to this. But also that here's what psychologists recently have started talking about. That there are societies that are more and less what we call weird, right? So Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. We are a very weird society in Britain. And, you know, then there are lots of other places on Earth that are less of those five things. But what's noticeable from the point of view of a psychologist is that people who live in weird countries are not just weird in any particular area, but they're weird in a few key ways where they're very far to one end of the spectrum compared to other human societies. And one of the main things that we're especially weird about is that we attribute failure or success to ourselves. We think it's about us. We think that whether we've succeeded in life is about whether we are individually good, bad, strong, persistent, got this, did this right. People in other societies would say, it's just what happens to you. It's fortune a lot of the time. And also they tend not to attribute anything particularly as much to internal characteristics. So we individualize success and failure to a very high degree in weird societies. And I think the growth mindset is interestingly partially an antidote to that problem. It's saying, oh, okay, well, you didn't manage to do the math problem this time, but it's not because you're stupid. It's not because you're bad at math. You just didn't solve that math problem this time and you're going to have to try it another way. So I guess my point really is we've got to try to be a little bit less weird in this one area and really just stop attributing it to ourselves. Because either it often is a matter of fate. Only one person is going to successfully create whatever giant tech company that is our cliche model of success. Or you know, it just takes a while to learn math. It's really important not to say that you're bad at math.
So I guess we take the ego out of it. We take ourselves out of the equation. And maybe that's part of our issue in terms of society is that we're making everything too much about ourselves and not enough about the collective. Yeah,
like, no one cares whether you individually are good or bad at math. It's just not how it works. You know,
no one cares apart from you.
Everyone's just got to figure out how to do long division. It takes time.
I can see Giles is kind of thinking about long division and getting
flashbacks. It's hard, honestly.
Well,
yeah.
I was going to say I failed my GCSE maths twice, but I just, you know, it wasn't a failure. It's just not for me. I'm good at
and I think that's part of the I was chatting to Giles before actually saying how you know, I remember the first time I failed an exam, and it was a big exam at medical school, and it was an exam that I wanted to pass, and I had all these ideas, and up till then I'd been on this escalator of next, you know, next exam, next achievement, next this, next that. And it was a massive shock for me, a huge shock, because I was like, oh my god, I've never failed anything. What does that mean about me? Who am I? What you know, what's going on here? And it sounds silly to say, but actually it was a really big moment for me, because I'd always been quite academic and always been someone who had done exams, and like I said, I had brothers and sisters who always passed everything, but it was the best thing that could have ever have happened to me, because it really calmed down my system. It really helped me see things from in a different light and about what was important, what wasn't important, and it really helped me to readjust to actually what I wanted in life. So looking back on that now, I just think, you know, that was ridiculous. I got in such a state about that. How stupid was that? But at the time, you know, I'm quite glad that I learned and I took some lessons from that and actually kind of changed my perspective on it. And you do see, you know, you do see a lot of the time this whole thing about perfection and about achievements and goals. And, you know, that causes serious mental health problems and serious mental health issues, isn't it? When we have this high level of perfectionism, this high level of I need to get everything right all the time. And it really can have really significant impacts on people's mental health and you know, predispose them to diagnoses and to developing mental health conditions as well that can be quite serious and quite significant.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a study recently that British school children are some of the unhappiest in the world, right? They're really unhappy. And I think, look, that would be important even if it didn't involve any mental health conditions, but it's all the more so because we are also having a major mental health crisis in this country at every level, and including with children, which is especially alarming, because it means that they're very likely to have them for the rest of their lives in many cases, and also because, you know, childhood is not a place where we're yet well equipped to deal with some of these things. So in any case, yeah, I mean, I think at one level we can say this in the sort of deep philosophical sense that, oh, well, it's really good that we're able to try to rethink this question of failure. But in another sense, it's a societal problem as well. And not just an individual thing that we should be thinking about. We should be thinking about how to make societies that are, and we say this in our book, actually, that are good for losers. We think it's really important that you make a society that's good for losers, because most of us are going to be losers at some point, right? If you have a society that's only designed for people who never screw up, then your society is not going to work for kind of anyone, including, interestingly, the people that win, in a way, I think. But that's another concept. But the main thing is you should make a society where it's possible to screw up and basically be fine, right? And previously, we've achieved this through the welfare state in certain areas, and that's still very important. But there are lots of other ways that we need to make it livable for people who are going to screw up, because that is going to be all of us, right? So it means we probably need to have a more tolerant view around things like divorce and infidelity and mental health breakdowns and dropping out of school for a while and doing something else and not necessarily having one career. And maybe it's perfectly fine to do, you know, a service or care work job for all of your life, and that's a success. And so we kind of have to reconceptualize everything once you begin to tease this problem of failure apart. But I think only if we could do this, both materially and culturally, could we have a place where it's possible for people to A, have fewer mental health problems, and B, not see those as a failure when they do experience them. So it's a collective problem. It's not just an individual thing. But you should individually buy the book. But, you know, we've got to do some other things as well.
But I mean, as you're talking, you know, you mentioned their divorce, you know, more than one career, you know, relationship breakdowns, I mean, all the things you're listing are life, aren't they?
Yeah,
they're all just life events that all of us are going to go through one or many of at any one point in our lives. And yet all of those have been kind of couched in the concept of you failed. And I was just thinking then, as you were speaking, how harsh our society is in terms of failure, because unless you get everything right in all these areas all the time for the rest of your life, you are a failure. And that's really harsh.
Yeah, we have the opposite view of the ancient Greeks, right? They said, okay, everyone has at least one massive tragic flaw in their personality. And some people even bring down entire countries with their massive tragic flaw, which we're seeing right now in the news. But our media cycle, for example, is extremely unforgiving, right? Because it's managed to capture our attention in a certain way. So we always joke about the tabloids, that if you look at a you know, it's not just the ancient Greeks, they obviously had Oedipus and so on, but even somebody like Flaubert writing about Madame Bovary, or Shakespeare's Hamlet, these characters are written in a very compelling way. There's something very interesting about Hamlet. He's clever, he's intelligent, he's a bit depressive, he's really obsessed with his uncle in a way that's a bit strange, and he's not very nice to his girlfriend, but, you know, there's something kind of lovable about Hamlet from moment to moment, and Hamlet is written in a very sympathetic way. But if he were written about by the tabloids, you know, they would say sort of like loser, whiny, 30-year-old still in graduate school, goes home for the weekend, causes massive numbers of death, right? I mean, there's a totally unsympathetic angle that our media would take. And
thank goodness Shakespeare was not a tabloid writer.
but we have responsibility for our tabloids, right? They're of course ruining individual lives that they write about all the time. I'm shocked, frankly, even as an American, to see the British tabloids. It's very weird. But more importantly, I think it's a problem for even the people that are not being profiled, because that's then how we see ourselves, right? I'm a 30-year-old graduate student, and the temptation is high to see myself. No, I'm kidding. But you see what I mean? You think, oh my gosh, it's apparently a horrible thing that, you know, these two celebrities are getting divorced because one of them made out with the girl in Starbucks. They're losers and failures, and now I must also be a dirty pervert loser as well. And I realize I'm using quite shocking language, but my point is that it's imbued into us all the time through the press, and we also, unfortunately, I think, perpetrate that language on each other. Right. We learn to gossip that way. We learn to judge ourselves internally that way. We click on the link and feed the Daily Mail or whatever. And it's a whole thing to unwind. It is a collective problem in that sense.
Yeah. No, you're right. Well, you know, everything that goes on social media, everything that goes on in print, on television, broadcasting, everything. Our culture is really a reflection of who we are individually. And we can either encourage that and kind of continue that, or we can try to change that. But it's, you know, both are intertwined. They're not separate. It's not like those platforms are doing something to us. We also have a responsibility. It's a two-way relationship, isn't it?
Yeah. But as the three of us are all content producers, I think we can think about it as an opportunity as well. But it's like something different, right?
Now, this podcast is all about things I forgot were good for me. So I'm curious to find out what your is, because obviously we're talking about failure, but is it actually that we've forgotten failure is good for us, or is it that we've forgotten that failure is normal, or is it something totally different?
Both. Yeah. I think it's sort of like a prior question to that. It's sort of like asking if, I don't know, living in a galaxy is good for us. Well, there is no other option. So here we are, right? You know, I don't know. No human has ever lived not in a galaxy. So in one sense, it's almost the wrong question. I think that nevertheless, there are many things about failure that really are good for us. Not least our ability to connect with others, to transcend our sense of self, which it turns out is very harmful to us for lots of reasons, to reprioritize, especially to reprioritize outside of certain kinds of actually quite impossible to achieve standards, and especially around material success, and putting it in quotes, success. I think it's very good for us in that way. And I think the other thing is mediocrity is very good for us too. I'm very into mediocrity. I think it's a wonderful, beautiful thing. And we should find lots of areas of life where we're very happy to be mediocre and pursue them lovingly, because it turns out, that is one of the places where we can experience things like flow, which is a state of sort of intense aliveness and attention, and time sort of passes without us even noticing it. Now, we might end up experiencing flow in something that we're doing that's really high level and we're great at it, but a lot of the time it's just something that we don't need the outcome to be perfect. Like, I make extremely mediocre sweaters for my friend's children. They're not very good. I haven't figured out cabling correctly at all, and I sew them together and you're supposed to do something else that I've never taught myself, and they're mediocre sweaters, but I don't care. And because I don't care, I actually enjoy it. And it turns out that, you know, these sweaters are not really the point, but lots of things in our lives are much more enjoyable once they no longer exist in that framework. So yeah, that's very good for us too, right?
I love that. I really love that. Yeah, I'm going to focus on being mediocre now. I think that's incredible. And there are so many examples as you were speaking of when I've been in that phase, and that's when I'm at my happiest, and that's when I've am my most joyful actually as well.
Yeah. It's so nice when the stakes are low.
Yeah.
And it's just unbearable what we place on ourselves. And yeah. Mediocrity. It's great. Let's go for it.
Oh, well, Sarah, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much. It's been fascinating.
Oh, it's been a delight to talk.
So thank you
so
much.
I'm looking forward to hearing it come out.
Oh, that was amazing, Sarah. My gosh, I learned so much. I mean, I've got the book anyway here, which I've been reading, but honestly, the way you speak about it is just fascinating. I learned so much in that 35 minutes. Oh my goodness me. It's incredible. Yeah, really incredible. Yeah, thank you. The end of another Things I Forgot Were Good For Me podcast episode. Thank you so much for joining us. I hope it's inspired you to go looking for all of the things that might help you feel a little bit better.
And hopefully we've inspired you to go looking for our podcast. You can find it on all good podcast platforms, probably some of the bad ones as well. You can also find us on social media. Our handle is Radha.
Yes, Giles, absolutely. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram @forgotpodcast. So go and find us there. We'd love to hear from you.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again next week.